Hi, this is Eric Schlein of the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode of the Intelligent Investing Podcast is sponsored by Red Rock Running. Runners and joggers out there, tell me if this sounds familiar. You go into your local running store to pick up some gear, first the shirt, and as you browse the shirts, you see that nice, high-quality performance shirt running you at least $40. Then, you need something to carry your smartphone so you can listen to the Intelligent Investing Podcast while you run. Or maybe you want to track your run with a GPS. A smartphone carrier costs something like $20 or $30. And between work, family, and other responsibilities, the only chance many of us have to go for a run is early in the morning or late at night. That often means running in the dark. So, to help stay safe, you need a reflective vest to increase visibility. That's another $10, $15. So, in total, you can expect to spend over $100 just for gear that goes on your upper body. Red Rock Running has a better way. Their new Bryce running shirt combines all three of those products into one simple item. Secure pockets built directly into each sleeve carry your smartphone or other audio device, a couple of keys, headphones, or energy gels. Strategically placed, reflective material increases your visibility, keeping you safe when running in the dark. Intelligent Investing Podcast listeners know the importance of value. Purchasing a technical shirt, smartphone carrier, and a reflective vest separately costs over $100. The Bryce running shirt, however, gives you all three for only $59. And Red Rock Running is offering listeners this podcast an additional 15% off any purchase by using the promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So that's right, listeners, if you are a listener of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you get an additional 15% off any purchase of a shirt that's already a good value by using that promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So remember, go to Red Rock Running, R-E-D-R-O-C-K, running.com, and receive 15% off your Bryce running shirt with promo code INVESTINGPOD, I-N-V-E-S-T-I-N-G-P-O-D. Carry more, increase visibility, decrease hassle.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You are listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have Nate Tobik on. Welcome to the show, Nate.
Hey, Eric, thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. So now for the listeners who do not know you, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, so I recently wrote a book, The Bank Investor's Handbook, and I also founded and run the website CompleteBankData.com, and I write a blog, OddballStocks.com. So kind of all over the place.
Now, did these things have anything in common to do with each other? The book, the blog, and the bank website?
Somewhat, yes. Yeah. So, I've been writing Oddball Stocks since 2010, and at some point I started getting interested in investing in banks. And what ended up happening after a little while was I just had a problem where I couldn't find a good screener to screen for bank stocks. And so a friend of mine said, hey, the FDIC publishes financial statements in a digital format. And I have a degree in computer science, and a friend of mine who I've worked with for a number of years, I said, hey, you know, why don't you write this program to pull in these statements, and then we'll have them in a database and we could screen for bank stocks. I said, I think it'll probably take 2 weeks. Well, he got excited about it. He just likes to code. And about 6 months later, we ended up finishing the first version of this product. And it's grown from there. So we finished it we launched it, I guess you could say, in 2014, beginning of 2014. And have just been working on it since. So, you know, he always jokes that anytime I estimate something, just multiply it by 10. So it's like, you know, I guess that's probably right. 2 weeks, you know, 20 weeks, that's in the ballpark. So anyways,
this will be about a 3 to 5 minute interview.
Seems about right.
Yeah, but, perfect.
Yeah, you know, so we launched the website, and I kept writing about banks, kept researching banks, and I wrote a post in 2013 just called A Banking Primer or Banker's Primer, something like that. And oddly enough, that is the highest, you know, there's some weeks there's 50 to 100 hits still a week, you know, four, almost 5 years later on that thing. And that's the highest hit post. And people would email me. They'd say, how do I look at a bank? How do I research a bank? What books are out there to find out how to analyze banks to invest in? And I've bought a ton of bank books on Amazon. A lot are very academic. A lot are dry.
I'll say they're very exciting, I'm sure.
Yeah, a lot are written by bankers. And it's just there was nothing that really filled this gap of – you know, what we're targeting is someone who understands financial statements, understands investments, but banks just seem a little weird. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, we want to write something that kind of cracks this open. And it's like, give people the tools to understand what is a bank, how do you research banks, what do you look for? And that's why we wrote the book.
Very interesting. And then tell us just a little bit, you mentioned Oddball Stocks, your blog. Tell us a little bit about what that is. I mean, I know what it is, but for the listeners out there who may not.
Right. So I used to write pretty prolifically. It's slowed down some, but I would just find unusual investments, basically. And a lot of them were deep value investments. Some of them were forward investments. And it was just things off the beaten path. So, you know, I wrote about one company that was trading for 2x earnings and something like 40% of net current assets. I still own that company, by the way. And, you know, just weird little things like that you come across in the market. And so years back,
is that company still trading at those valuations?
It's not as cheap now, but it's still pretty reasonable. Yeah, there are companies out there. I have a company. It's Goodhart Wilcox. The ticker is GWOX. And they do textbook manufacturing in Texas and Illinois or something like that. And for years, since the financial crisis, they kept saying, once the economy recovers, we're going to finally start to make money. And I'm just going off the back of the top of my head here, but I want to say they traded like $75 a share. They have something like 45 or 50 a share in cash, leaving you, you know, essentially the business is worth about 20 bucks a share. And for years, they would earn, you know, $2 to $5 a share. And this year, they sent out the first quarterly letter. They said, "We finally have things finally turned up in Texas, just like we've been expecting." And they earned something like $15 a share. And then I just received the second quarterly letter, and they earned something like that again. So, you know, now they're trading at 1x earnings or less than 1x earnings. Who knows if it's sustainable, but there are definitely things out there like that. Now, the problem with these guys is brokerages have become scared at letting investors trade these stocks. So I own shares at Fidelity. Fidelity will let me sell, but I can't buy anything else. I also have an account at Interactive Brokers. They said they won't touch the stock. Now, I know I do have a contact who is a broker who said that he could probably trade the position. But, you know, you have to open up a whole brokerage account and everything. So it's tough. But, yes, these things do exist still. Not many, but they're out there.
Interesting. So then Oddball Stocks is basically a bunch of weird companies like this that are under the radar.
That's exactly it, yes.
And what had you start that website? How did you get into that?
So this was back in 2007, I was investing, and I thought, you know what, I want to be an equity analyst is my profession. I started taking the CFA exams, took level one, and then took level two. I was doing a bunch of networking, and what I kept hearing was, so I was a software developer at the time, and people said, oh, you could easily switch to being an analyst, but you're going to take a 30 to 50% pay haircut, and you won't be able to invest any of your own money. It'll just be, you know, you have to buy what's on the restricted list or whatever. So in 2010, I took the CFA level two. I failed it. And we were on vacation down in Florida. And I was just kind of sitting reflecting on this. And I thought, you know, I have two choices, right? So the one choice is I take another 6 months. It was actually another year to retake level two. I take a year and spend a year studying, pass this thing. Another year after that, I take the level three, try and work my way into this. Or I could just take all that time I was using studying and just invest my own money. I can invest in whatever I want. I don't have to ask my boss. I don't have to ask my employer. They didn't care what I was doing with investments. And I, you know, I wouldn't be doing the CFA thing. So I decided to go that route, and I'm mildly disorganized. And so I thought I need a place to capture what I'm researching. So I thought I'll just start some sort of a blog to just capture it. I could always go to my own research online, reread it. And, you know, it's almost like an online journal.
Right, yeah.
And people started to read it, and then more people started to read it. And then suddenly I had an audience, and I thought, this is crazy. But, you know, the reality was there were other people investing in these stocks, but not many other people were writing about them. And that's, you just have to find a niche like that. And, you know, all sorts of doors open up.
Very cool. And then, so you've been doing that since 2007. And then you're familiar with the Walker's Manual, I assume?
I am. And I, you know, so what got me started on Complete Bank Data is at first I tried to build an online Walker's Manual. And I thought I could do the same thing these guys were doing, but I'll do it online and I'm going to become so rich. I'm just going to make all this money. So what ended up happening was something totally different. I bought shares in all sorts of companies. I built some software. It was rudimentary, but I built it. And then I'm sitting there with, I don't know, 50 or 100 annual reports from these little dark companies. And I started to realize, you know, the problem is you need to normalize these financial statements because how one company reports is different from another company. And, you know, a lot of them, they're not SEC reporting. Who knows what standard they're using anyways. It's just whatever their accounting firm wants to use. And so I had to build the software to normalize these things. And so I ended up entering in, you know, I think it was 100-something companies. It was all by hand. So I'm retyping all these financial statements by hand. And then the quarterly updates I'm typing by hand. And I was trying to sell subscriptions on the blog and people aren't really buying it. And I realized there's a reason the Walker's guys are not selling books anymore. It's just not a viable business. And, you know, I think for people who are interested in that, buy a share in a bunch of companies, keep track on your own. But I don't think there's a way to really publish this and, you know, make money at it. But So having that software base, that's what I convinced Eric, my co-founder. I said, just use what I already wrote and then write it for bank data. And he looked at me and goes, oh, this is garbage. We need to rewrite it. And, you know, then the cycle began. But the whole idea of doing a digital Walker's Manual was the first foray into all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a great idea if you didn't know it wasn't going to work.
It does. And, you know, it's even tougher now because a lot of brokers won't let you trade these stocks. And, you know, the deals that existed, I think it was – I was kind of a victim of time and place. So I did this in 2012. I started end of 2011, beginning of 2012. We got it live in beginning of 2012. You know, at that time, coming out of the financial crisis – there were a ton of really cheap dark companies, and it seemed like a no-brainer to be investing in these things. And it just, you know, now I look at that and I think there's still deals in that space, but it's not as many as before. And if I were to come in fresh today, I wouldn't think I should build a digital version of this. You know, and so interestingly enough, one thing that helped open my eyes to that is I met a hedge fund manager in 2013 who was asking me about that. And he said, you know, you need to think about scalable strategies and things that persist through time. And, you know, he obviously had a lot more experience than I did. And it got me thinking about investing in banks. And so we were already starting to write this bank investing software, and I was already investing in banks. But it really got the gears turning to think that, you know, that's a timeless strategy, right? We've had people who are money intermediaries since, you know, the Babylonians, and there's always a need for someone who is able to connect people who have money to connect them to the people who need money. Right. And whatever that form is, those people have always existed. And, you know, so I guess you could say I kind of changed, you know, switched strategies. I mean, I didn't really. I keep doing the dark stuff. But as that started to wane, I poured more and invested more into banks because it's a timeless thing. And, yes, banks are cyclical. So right now you're not going to find many that are trading at 50% of book value. But that doesn't matter because it's always something you could invest in. And there's always banks that are undervalued relative to others. There's always banks that are good performers that are able to buy the poor performers, squeeze out efficiencies, and grow. And, you know, it's such a big market. So, I mean, there's about 1,000 traded banks. I mean, that's so many different stocks to work in and out of just in that marketplace alone. And, you know, as a testament to that, there's people and funds that are bank-specific investment funds. And, you know, I don't really, you know, there's some other ones. There's, you know, consumer mutual funds, you know, mining or metals, but there aren't that many, but there's always bank funds. And it's just because there's so much opportunity in that space. So if you're trying to build a portfolio of 15 or 20 of these banks at one time, you're always going to be able to find something to buy.
Now, when you're looking for bank stocks, you know, what do you typically look for as someone that's looking for value in the banking sector?
Right. Well, so it changes over time, and you know, I think that's if I can impress one thing on listeners, it's that you need to be flexible throughout the market cycle. And so, a couple of years ago, maybe say 2.5 years ago, you could run a screen and there was about 45 stocks, bank stocks trading at 50% of book. And, you know, truth be told, these were pretty crummy banks. So some of them were still losing money. Others had severe issues from the financial crisis. You know, but the economy was recovering and it was doing well. And if you would have bought a single share of every one of those banks, you would have outperformed. And, you know, those are just deep value.
Yeah.
Now, if you would have went back 2.5 years before that, you would have had to been a little bit more selective because not all of those banks that were losing money or doing poorly really turned out okay. You know, so coming out of the crisis, there were deep value banks, say at 40 or 50% of book value, selling to another bank at 80% of book value. And, you know, some of the chatter in the space is maybe valuations, maybe banks are only worth 80% of book. Maybe they're only worth 90% of book. You know, and things keep ratcheting up as the economy gets better. But in general, a couple of years ago, you could have just bought all of these at 50% of book and done well and just not even thought about it. Now the space isn't the same. There's a few that are trading at discounts, but it's just not as many as before. And you need to be more flexible in your approach. So
let me ask you something. So I remember even before, you know, 2 years ago when a lot of banks were trading at, you know, fractions of their book value. And the big fear then was, well, it looks like it's trading at half a book value, but what's the actual book value? They're going to have to, you know, write down a bunch of loans. You know, how stable are these loans? And, you know, is in a year from now, is it going to really be 90 cents on the dollar of book value and then low return on equity for the next 10 years, right? So, like, there's a lot of fears like that. So how would you be able to, it's easy to look in hindsight and say, well, that's obvious. But back then, how would you have been able to figure out, you know, sort of the, I guess, an estimate on, like, the real book value of a lot of these companies?
Right. So I have two answers to that. I'll give you the easy answer first, and then I'll give you the more in-depth one. So the easy answer is this, is for whatever reason, when someone sees, a company that makes shoes in Milwaukee trading at 60% of book, and their book value is some machines and a building and whatever else, they say, oh, of course this stuff is probably worth book value. Without even thinking, it's some industrial company. It seems easy to understand. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to say, sure, they're worth book. But when someone sees a bank trading at 60% of book, they say, well, what are the loans? I don't understand. And, it's a black box.
It feels more mysterious is what it is, right?
It does. And I would argue that shoemaker in Milwaukee probably has machines from 1940 that are worthless. And, the building, they probably couldn't resell because it's in a crummy industrial area. And in a lot of cases, it really isn't worth book value. And so the more in-depth answer is this, is every loan that a bank makes, if it's a residential loan or if it's a commercial lien, is part of the public record. So if you were interested, you could actually pull almost every loan for a bank's loan book and evaluate it individually. And that's actually – so as we progressed with the software, we actually got to that point. And we're doing that now in certain states. So you could pull up, First Bank of anywhere and in states that we cover, and you could see every individual loan that they've made to residential borrowers and commercial borrowers. And so if you were really worried about that book value, you could see those on Google Maps and you could say, do I think this house is really worth what the value of that loan is on the house? And you could go in there. But what I would say is this, is if you're at the level that you're questioning the individual loans and the value of those loans, that's probably not an investment you want to make.
Right.
So, when I look at investments, it's a statistical thing, right? So you say, is it likely that something that's at 60% of book, is it more likely that it's worth one times book or zero? And if you weigh all the evidence and you say there's a greater chance it's worth one times book than it is zero, then that's a buy. And, some people need to satisfy some intellectual curiosity. And they want to look at every single loan. Mm-hmm. And you could do that. The use case we found for that is not for investors. It's more for banks. So banks want to see the lending market share in a county. They want to see who their competitors have lent money to. They want to see where they lost deals. Who did those deals that they lost go to? So that's the value in that data. It's not as much someone who wants to look tract by tract and say, what's the true book value. But so my point is this: overall, with a bank, you could actually get down to the granular loan level, and if you wanted to, you could calculate what that absolute book value is. Mm-hmm. Where you cannot do that for the shoe manufacturer in Milwaukee.
Right. Interesting. And then I guess another point you could also make is if that company is struggling to sell product, right, and is in a distressed situation, it's like, is someone going to want to buy, their inventory, right?
That's exactly it. I've bought my share of distressed industrials. And I've done well with them, mostly because it's that math. There's a greater chance that they're worth something than worth nothing.
Right.
But I love asset-based investing because it's simple. So you could look at something and you say, is this dollar that's trading for 50 cents really worth a dollar or not? And it's just a simple question. But, you know, the market does reward companies based on earnings. And if that dollar is worth a dollar and each year they're cutting off a piece of it and after 5 or 10 years it's going to be worth 50 cents, you know, you're working against time. Whereas if you could buy a company that's at a distressed valuation but it has earnings and book value is growing, then time's at your back. And so, you know, say you buy something at 50% of book and they're growing at, you know, say 10%. So in 7 years, and the price hasn't changed, it's now worth 25% of book. And then 10 years later, it's worth 12% of book. And 10 years after that, you know, you're at 6%. And you say, it's almost impossible for that situation to persist.
Right.
Because the longer you wait, the more that valuation discount works in your favor. So maybe it's not a good deal at 50. Is it a good deal at 25? Is it a good deal at 12? The longer you wait with those positive earnings, that eventually the market's going to say, well, I didn't like it at 50, but I like it at 25. And the thing is, when the market likes something, there's a lot of momentum behind it. So it's not one or two people saying, I like this, I'll bid on a few shares. It's you're waiting for the market to catch on. And when you get that momentum, it's not going to go from 25 to 50. It might go from 25 to 80 or, you know, 25 to 150 or whatever it is. And that's when you can make your money.
Right. Now, are you finding bank stocks today that are trading below book that are profitable?
Yeah, there's a handful of them. Not a ton. You know, so one area where you could find profitable bank stocks, sometimes a good discounts, is mutual banks and sometimes mutual banks that are converting to stock banks. And, you know, those I kind of consider them the net-nets of the banking world. So these aren't great banks. And you know, every time I write about one of these or suggest that to some people, you know, the response from someone is always the same. Say, oh, well, they're only earning 3% on their equity. You know, I'm not interested in such a low performer. They're not earning their cost of capital. But the reality is, if you buy enough of these things, excuse me, if you buy enough of these things at a discount and you just hold on, you're going to double your money in most cases. And it's a numbers game. You know, I wouldn't suggest looking for the one or two best mutual banks at a discount. They're all about the same. You just buy them all. You buy all of them that hit your criteria and you hold on. And as they pop, you sell. You know, and it's.
So are you talking about after they do the conversion and they become publicly traded? Is that what you're talking about? Or
yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's some people out there who are trying to travel the country, get deposits at all these banks. There's a bank real near us, Slovak Savings Bank, is a mutual bank they're converting. So if you had money in them as a depositor, you would end up owning – you could subscribe to the IPO and own shares. You know, the thing is this. There's I don't know the number offhand, 400 or 500 mutual banks nationwide. And a lot of them are hard to get into. A lot of them are small. So Slovak Savings Bank, they had one branch right near downtown Pittsburgh, and now they have another one in the North Hills. But they're little branches, and their new branch is just a window and kind of a, you know, Class C office building off the main drag. You know, so these aren't great banks. And the big wave of mutual conversions happened in the 80s and the 90s. So we're really at the long tail of the distribution here. But these things are still happening. They're small banks. The bankers are trying to cash out. Sometimes there's really interesting ones. Another bank in Pittsburgh is Dollar Bank. I think they're $5 or $6 billion. They're mutual. It's unlikely they'll ever convert. But it's, you know, my point is, it's not worth your time trying to chase down deposits in these things, because it's hard to get in. It's hard to get accounts. There's the time value of all that travel. Mm-hmm. When in most cases now you could buy after the IPO and, you know, maybe it pops 10% on the first day. But, you know, so they IPO generally at $8 or $10 a share. So if you say, okay, it jumps up to 11 a share. But in most cases, they sell at 20, 25 a share. So you say, did that dollar a share really matter in the long run? Not over a basket of them, it didn't.
Now, why when these mutual conversions happen, why do they end up trading at such depressed valuations?
Well, it's the nature of the mechanics. So
explain that to the listeners.
Sure. So a mutual bank is this. It's just a co-op. You know, they're essentially credit unions, a little bit different, a different type of charter. But in a credit union or a mutual bank, the depositors are the true owners. So, you know, say you got 10 people together, everyone put in $1,000, and that's the bank. So you have 10,000 in equity, and, you know, it does its banking thing for years. And then one day management decides, you know what, we want an IPO. And say equity's grown substantially, and I don't know, now it's worth, you know, 5,000 a person. So $50,000 in equity. So, but you don't own shares. It's just a co-op, you know, like a food co-op. If you were to do like one of those farm market co-op things, you know, you own part of that, but you can't vote on if you want to get asparagus or broccoli. It's just, you're just part of this group and everyone cooperatively owns it. And a mutual is like that too. So, you know, say they want to do an IPO. Management decides we're tired of running this thing. We want to cash out. And that's one motivation. The second motivation is a mutual bank cannot raise money in the capital markets. So you've got your 10 people who are in and equity is worth $50,000. If they said there's an opportunity that we really need to grow, we need another $50,000, they would have to get it from the depositors. They can't raise money. Whereas if you're just a normal common stock bank, you could sell shares to someone, you could sell preferred stock, you could have a bond offering. You know, there's all sorts of financial instruments to raise capital. That doesn't exist for mutual banks. So if they want to grow, or if management has decided they'd like to cash out, they say, well, let's do an IPO. So what they do is they say, we're going to do an IPO, and equity's $50,000. We'll offer it at, you know, $10 a share and sell 5,000 shares. So they sell 5,000 shares at $10 a share, and that raises another $50,000. And, you know, let's say the investment bankers are nice. They don't charge any fees. So equity is now $100,000, but they only sold, you know, they sold the ownership. So now you have your $10, like what you bought for $10 a share is really worth double. And, you know, it doesn't always work out like that. Sometimes you're at 70%. Sometimes it's book value. But in general, the mechanics are you're buying into that cash equity that already exists. And so whatever you're buying is doubled, or there's some percentage on top of it. So that's why you have the discount. And, you know, these things will pop on the first day they trade. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they drop. And a lot of times what's happening is people who are putting their money into the deposits, they're in for that pop. So say you had money in these banks, and there's almost like this band of professional depositors out there who help float this thing. So you're doing the IPO. These depositors who had little toehold positions, they say, we're going to be the ones to buy those 5,000 shares at $10 a share. And they pony up the money because, you know, let's be realistic. Most depositors at a bank, they don't have much in their account. And if you ask them, hey, are you interested in buying $150,000 worth of some IPO? Most people are not. They just don't have it. They don't even have $5,000. So this is just fanciful stuff. But this, you know, this kind of roving band of depositors, they've got the cash. They dump it in the IPO. The thing pops 10%. They're rewarded for that, and they move on. I mean, that's – and, you know, so if you're in that and you have these deposits and you could do three or four different IPOs a year, you know, so think about that. That's 40% on your original capital with almost no risk. You know, you put your 100 grand in, boom, it pops, you made 10 grand. You could actually put that 110 in the next one, and then, you know, you make 11,000 bucks. And you just – so for those people who are doing that, that's an incredible return, but that needs to be weighed against getting into those accounts. And, you know, it's just a form of arbitrage. They're not in it for the long run. But I think savvy investors who buy in after these IPOs could do just as well.
Yeah. Very interesting. So what kind of bank stocks are you looking at in today's environment?
So it's tough. It's you know, it depends. I still have a number of these positions. A lot of them were just value stocks, and I've held on to some that are really good operators. So there's one bank I've liked for years, FSBW, and they do a sort of it's like a niche construction lending and handyman lending. So they do really short-term loans to home improvement companies. And I think they're in Seattle or Washington area. So their business model is this. You have someone who does home improvements, and they show up to a job. Someone wants to redo their basement, and it's going to cost $30,000 to redo their basement. And of that $30,000, $15,000 in materials. And the customer says, well, I'll do $5,000 or $10,000 down and then, you know, pay the rest once it's done. So to that person, they don't have the cash up front to buy the materials, and they have the labor to pay for. So they take out a loan, and they buy the materials for the job. They use the deposit for the job to pay labor. And then when they finish the job, they pay off, you know, everything's paid off, and they made the same money that they would have made, but they were able to, they had that liquidity up front to do that. And so these guys have done really well, and they've grown like crazy. Their metrics are all sound. They're great at managing risk. And, you know, the stock's gone up, I don't know, 300, 400%, something like that. It's wild. And as they've grown, they continue to execute well. And so what that tells me is that they aren't a one-trick pony. You know, the team that's there is – they know how to sell. And I'd say right now you want to find banks that have a really good sales culture, and they have a good sales culture, especially around commercial loans. You know, another bank is I think it's CBBW, maybe not. It's CBB Bank. It's a business bank in LA. I've owned them. They have a great sales culture doing commercial lending, and you know, they're just – They know how to grow. They're able to find sticky deposits, and that's what's valuable right now. So as rates are going up, we're heading into an environment where suddenly deposits and deposit costs matter. And, you know, a lot of these little banks, and unfortunately most of the smaller banks, are all doing residential lending, which is probably the worst type of lending you could be in. You know, they're seeing their deposit base asking for higher rates on CDs, higher rates on checking accounts, higher rates on everything, and they're just not making much more on mortgages. You know, so if you look at a mortgage now, it's about the same as it was as a couple years ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, what they need to pay on deposits is higher. And so they're getting squished. And these are the same people. So here's a litmus test. I like to look at annual letters from banks, and what I find fascinating is there are still bankers out there who are writing these letters saying the economy is terrible, the political environment is terrible, regulation is terrible, we've never recovered from the financial crisis, everything is terrible. And, you know, it's the Debbie Downer. So there's a local guy. I've gone to his annual meetings a couple times. And he said, this might have been 2 or 3 years ago, he said, you know, rates should be about 6.5% right now. That we should be lending at about 6.5%, and we're not going to deploy our cash until that's what we can get on mortgages. And, you know, there were a couple of us in the audience who just thought, this guy's insane. It's never going to be like that. And if you can't maneuver in the current environment, you're just never going to know how to make money. And, you know, sure enough, his stock was at like 10 bucks a share back then. Now I think it's at 1240 or something. So it's barely moved. And investors aren't stupid. They know that people like him, they have no sales culture. They don't know how to grow. And he's just waiting for the tide to carry his bank along. And unfortunately, in the environment we're in, the tide's actually carried him out to sea.
Yeah. Interesting. And how do you find these things?
So that's a good question. I mean, I'll use our software to find banks. The way I've found it, pretty much every stock I've invested in, there's really a couple ways. Number one is I'll just get a list of stocks, and anyone could do this. So you could just get a list of banks and just grind through them and just, you know, look at them one by one. So I think there's something like 438 banks that trade on the New York Stock Exchange and on NASDAQ. You can get that list online of those tickers.
Do you look at oddball bank stocks essentially?
Yeah, I look at those. I mean, I'll invest in any bank really. Yeah. You know, I owned Citizens Bank for a while. It's a bigger bank, and it was kind of a recovery play. You know, after they were sold off by Royal Bank Shares, you know, so I'm agnostic to that. You know, so the small banks are easy to invest in some ways because they're so simple.
Yeah.
But what I would say right now, the sweet spot for banks is banks that are probably at a minimum, maybe 800 million in assets, but that 800 million comes with a caveat. It's 800 million and they're growing. And, you know, you really need growth at this point. And if there's no growth, the bank needs to be really cheap.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about? Because I have one more question for you, if there isn't.
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but are there any sort of off the radar companies that look most interesting to you right now that you think are worth further due diligence? And then are there any, and then what would be your favorite bank stock right now?
Okay. So off the radar companies. Yeah, I have a couple. So, you know, Goodhart Wilcox, I mentioned them. Another is Coal Creek. Yep. Coal Creek. And I think that's CCRK. So I think what's interesting about them is they own a bunch of timberland and land down in Tennessee. And, you know, so you can make the argument, oh, they're worth whatever timberland goes for times however many acres. But these guys kind of realize something that timberland isn't an awesome business. I do like some timber companies, but you could do more with it. So they've been monetizing it. So what they did is they built a campground. They built ATV tracks. So they built lodges, like little cabins. And there's a general store. And they have all these events. So, you know, they're basically what's happening is people will go down there. And they'll camp at the campground. They'll take their quads. They'll take their dirt bikes. And they pay to use the track and all these trails through the woods. They go nuts on these things. They spend all weekend. And, you know, the company in their store, you know, they're selling them food. They're selling them drinks. They're selling them booze. They're selling, you know, spare parts for the bikes and the quads. And, you know, it's a good business. And they still have the timber. And so that's the interesting thing is trees don't care if someone's driving a dirt bike around them. You know, they're still going to grow. As long as there's sun and there's rain, a tree's going to grow. And so they're monetizing this ground. And at the same time, they still have the timber. And so they harvest some timber. You know, and it's a good company. They're on a really good trajectory. I think shares trade at something 300 something a share, 330, 380, something like that.
Are there financials public, or do you have to?
You have to buy a share and then contact them, and they'll send you something. Yes.
So, yeah. Legally, are you allowed to talk about the financials? Or
Yeah. I mean, you can. You know, once someone gives that out, you could talk about it, and it's actually. Some companies will try and tie you up with an NDA, mm-hmm. which I won't sign, but, you know, they say you can't talk about this stuff. And it's really – I think that's a really legal gray area because you can't copyright facts,
right.
And you can't copyright numbers. So you can't say that if we made $1,000 last year – versus $800 the year before, that's copyright and you're not allowed to distribute that because a number is not copyrightable. And if you're a legal owner of the company, a lot of state and national law backs up the fact that you own this and you could share it and do as you like because you are a part owner. So, I have no qualms sharing financials from companies like that. But at the same time, sometimes you find a little gem and you don't necessarily want to share them until you have a good position yourself. So that's what I would say on that. I would say in terms of a bank, let me see if I could find this bank here. These guys in LA, I think it's CB Business Bank, CBB Business Bank.
Okay.
Let's see. Yeah, CBB Business Bank. And I really like what they're doing. They're growing. They recently formed a holding company. They've expanded into Texas. They understand business banking. So it's, you know, it's one of these things. If you're going to get into there's residential banks and then there's business banks. And there's a wide gulf between these two. And let me explain why.
Okay.
So if you're doing residential lending, there's not much room for a market, right? So, you know, a bank in a city, maybe there's a couple different strata of houses. So you have a small, medium, large house. But the person who's buying a house is going to go on bankrate.com. They're going to go on other sites and they're going to say, if the prevailing rate is 4%, I expect to be right around there. So maybe 4 1/8, maybe 4 1/4 if there's some sort of a reason that they would pay that much more or slightly less than 4. And everyone wants that competitive rate. And mortgage brokers and banks are all competing on that. So when you're doing a residential loan, it's right around that prevailing rate. And deposits are paid on a prevailing rate. So if every other bank is paying 2% on their CDs, your bank sure as heck better be paying 2% too, because it's really easy to take your money two doors down and get a higher rate. And there's a lot of people who bounce around for these CD rates. So, you know, that's the world on residential lending. Now, commercial lending is different because each business is different. You know, there are similar businesses, but they're not the same.
Right.
And so what you get is a savvy banker could say, well, I could charge this guy 6.5 for, and maybe someone down the street is trying to charge him 6, but the guy at 6.5 says, well, you know, we could offer some perks with that. And a perk might be, we're willing to finance your inventory or, you know, we could do special terms. And there's a lot of different negotiating points on a commercial loan versus a residential loan. You know, when you're closing on your house, there isn't much to negotiate on. It's like, I need the money by the closing date.
Right.
And as long as it's 30 years or 15 years, that's all I care about. And with a commercial loan, there's so many different variables. And so a savvy banker could really work those variables and earn a quarter, a half, a percent higher than someone who isn't savvy and still earn that business. So there's a much higher rate on business loans. You could also, with a person's state, a person's residential lending, you see their income statement, you see what's in their bank accounts, you see their investments, but that's really it. You don't know how they're doing at their job. You know, a bank isn't calling saying, "Hey, are Joe and Sally, are they good employees? Are they bad employees? Do their coworkers hate that they cook fish every Thursday? You know, like what's going on with them?"
Yeah.
You don't know that, but when you look at a business's financial statements, just like anyone who's analyzing a stock, you could discern. You could say the history, if the future is similar to the past, and this is a very stable business, then it's likely in the future they're going to earn similar to what they earned in the past, and we could loan them, some X amount that's easily covered. And so there's a little bit more insight. And the last piece is oftentimes a bank requires, when they extend a commercial loan, they require that commercial borrower keep money on deposit at the bank, a certain amount. And they're not allowed to go below that. So say you got $1 million loan, maybe you have to keep $150,000 in your account at all time. So, one way, and that $150,000 isn't, you're not getting interest on that. Which perversely, if you think about it, you put $150,000 in, they gave you $1 million back. So, you essentially got $850,000 from the bank and you're $150,000 back and you're paying interest on the full thing. So those are sticky deposits. Business deposits are really good deposits because they can't leave easily. They've got their loan tied up there. It's a lot of work to get a new business loan. And most business loans are relationship driven. So you know your business banker. And if that business banker is moving to a different bank, you'll probably move with them. And that's because that person has banked with you for years. They know your company's history. They know the ups and downs of your business. They understand how you handle crisis, how you handle the good years just as well as the bad years. And when that's how they evaluate whether or not they should loan you the money. And you can't beat that in a lot of ways. And so you have those deposits that are stuck. You're not just going to jump ship to some guy across town unless you're a bad credit. And that's the thing. So if you're a business and you're bouncing around between banks all the time, you're probably not a good credit. You're not actually a credit that a bank wants to have. That, it's one of those things. I've heard a banker told me, when you see there's some poor quality credits that he knew in his area, and he said they keep bouncing to new banks, and he said you could just tell which banks hired a new loan officer because they didn't know their history yet, and they didn't know that this was a dangerous thing, and they were going to default or get into problems. And so, that you want to look for the business lending, good quality business lending, and that brings those sticky deposits. So I would say right now, look for banks that are doing that. Residential lending isn't a bad place to be, but you don't want to be in a bank that's all residential. You want to have a good mix of commercial, residential, some construction. Right at this point in the cycle, I'd be very wary of having a lot of construction lending just because, once the air goes out of the balloon, those construction loans are going to be marked to zero.
So follow-up question to that, what does a savvy banker or a savvy management team in that sector understand what you just said and be positioning accordingly?
Savvy ones, yes. So there's other ones who are racing for yield. And
that's like any industry, right? But you're just saying construction, it's worse in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, construction's bad because, so what kills construction is this. I reference this sort of a thing in the book too. There's a great blog post out there by David Merkel, and he talks about bicycle stability versus coffee table stability. And the idea is that a coffee table is stable at rest, and a bike is stable in motion, but at rest, there's no stability at all. It just falls over. And so I would say construction lending has a lot of aspects of bicycle stability. When things are going well and projects are being completed, this looks like the most stable bank in the world because the loans are paid once the construction's done. Everything looks great with them. The problem is if there's the slightest downturn or construction slows up for any reason, those developers who all they did was bulldoze the land, they're not interested in doing anything else. And they're done. And the bank's left holding the bag. And there's no stability in that. So some construction lending can be okay, but I would be very worried. And especially now, I mean, things are just hitting on all cylinders everywhere. And it kind of reminds me, I was in Florida in July of 2006, and everywhere you turned in South Florida was a new condo building, was a new office building, was a new everything. And the prices were crazy, and there was all this euphoria and enthusiasm. And 3 years later, I was there in March 2009. And so there was these condos in a building, we always stayed next to it, that had been $500,000-$600,000 right on the ocean in 2006. And in 2009, they were for sale for $150,000. And there's abandoned construction projects everywhere. And then there was banks that had entered receivership that had owned all these construction loans, and those buildings were for sale. You know, so it'd be some old bank, there's weeds around it, there's a sign, commercial real estate for sale. And you think, if you wanted to buy a bank branch, there's hundreds of them. And, you know, the air was out of the bubble at that point. Yeah. And all those banks all went under because they had all this exposure. Now, eventually, years later, Florida came back and the economy grew and the market grew and it filled in all those gaps. But those banks never lived to take advantage of it because they were left holding the bag and they had too much exposure.
Very interesting. Well, hey, this was great. I really appreciate you coming on.
Well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a fun discussion.
Yeah, and for any listeners who want to learn more, where could they find more of the bank data or your blog? You know, just want to give out some info.
Yeah, for sure. So if you're interested in learning more about banks, learning how to understand, analyze banks, buy the book. It's called The Bank Investor's Handbook. It's on Amazon. It's on the Kindle. If you are a banker and you are looking to gain a competitive advantage over other banks in your area, check out completebankdata.com or shoot me an email. It's ntobik@completebankdata.com. If you're an investor looking for an edge on bank stocks, you could also check out the website. And if you're just looking for quirky, off-the-beaten-path investment ideas, check out oddballstocks.com.
All right, great. Sounds good. Well, I hope you have a great rest of your evening.
All right. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.